This is Beverly Tomasi, and I'd like to welcome all of you to our Diabetes Bootcamp Class 2. This is a very exciting topic because it integrates a lot of different concepts. And as with our previous boot camps, we have a lot to cover. I've limited it myself to 90 slides, so we have a slide a minute, which means we're going to be stomping right through the content. So welcome, and let's get going. This is our first boot camp series ever, and this has been really fun for all of us, and it's exciting to reach out to you all over the country and share this really important information about diabetes education. As you know, this program will be recorded and available for viewing within 4 hours of completion of the session. It does take us some time to get everything up and running. There's a lot of technology behind the scenes. This is Lainey Kosky, our wonderful Vice President of Operations. She keeps everything running smoothly, and if you have any questions, you just go ahead and contact her. So Bootcamp 2, I was reviewing back to see what content I was supposed to cover, standards of care, treatment of hypertension, and hyperlipidemia, but then I realized we need to also cover hypoglycemia monitoring and sick days plus assessment. So I added the hypo monitoring and sick days in addition to the other content to make sure that I cover the critical information that's not in the other online courses. And I just want to point out a few things on the resource page content. I did load up the slides last night, as you can see here, and there's a second version here with poll questions. So I did add 8 poll questions, and I thought maybe you all want to have a copy of those. So I just made a second handout that includes those. I've also put a diabetes health record for patients, a great thing to print out and have your patients keep on board with them in their wallet to document how their health is going. There's a ton of prevention website and resources. Flu vaccine, how to talk your patients into getting a flu vaccine. A lot of patients don't want to. Hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia patient education sheet. You're going to love this one. You've seen it before. It's really terrific. Medication wallet card. Patients are on a ton of medications. How do they keep track? You can print this out, put your logo on, and they can keep track. Medication summary sheets and study tools. I'm going to be talking today about antihypertension medications, cholesterol-lowering medications. I won't be talking about neuropathy medications, but that's in one of our online courses. Anyways, these are study sheets you can download and have a complete listing of all the different medications, because they will, let me just go back a page because now you're going to be looking at that. During the exam, they are going to ask some basic questions about lipid meds, hypertension meds, and they might ask some questions about meds for neuropathy also. So I put together these summary sheets in partnership with my husband, who's a pharmacist, to give you all a resource. And I use these in my clinic setting because I have a hard time keeping track of all these medications, and it's a nice sheet for that too. So as you know, I like to kick it off with a poll question to get our brains on fire, fired up, and ready for this exam. And also, I feel like these poll questions are a really nice way for me to help get you thinking about important issues that appear on the exam. Which of the following diabetes self-care behaviors are part of the AADE7? So you may say, I'm not sure what that is. So if you don't know, that's okay, because that would be something then you would like to study and be familiar with, because it will appear on the exam. So let me launch this. Is it compliance? And there's only one right answer today. Assessment, adherence, or reducing risk. And if you're looking at your handout and you can see that the next slide provides the answer, maybe you want to cover that next slide. That's a little bit of an issue with these poll questions, because the answer does lie within. So you might want to just not look and make your best guess. All right. 70% of you have voted, so take your best guess. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. Thanks, everybody. So I brought this question up because during the exam, they're going to be asking about AADE7. They're going to be talking about it. And here's what you chose. 80% of you got the right answer. One of the AADE7 is reducing risk. So let me just go to the next slide now. The AADE, and as you all know, AADE is American Association of Diabetes Educators, and they're the ones that help construct this exam, have identified 7 self-care behaviors that patients need to be familiar with, or as educators we need to coach patients on: healthy eating, being active, monitoring, taking medication, problem solving, healthy coping, and reducing risk. So when we're sitting across from that patient and assessing their diabetes self-care, we're assessing in these 7 different quadrants to evaluate how they're doing in each of these. And how do we assess those behaviors? We're going to ask a lot of questions. So when our patients come in, we're automatically starting to assess them. We see how they walk in, how they sit down, if they brought their paperwork or they didn't bring their paperwork, did they bring their logbook, do they keep a food diary or no food diary, how skilled and comfortable do they seem with diabetes management, what's their support like, do they have any support people, and how safe are they at diabetes management. And we're also going to be assessing their beliefs, attitudes, and readiness. And based on that assessment, it's going to help us understand how much information to share with them. See, if you look at this picture of this first guy, how is he feeling about his diabetes? Well, we're not going to say he's happy for sure. And he might actually be saying right here, I don't have diabetes. I don't know why the doctor sent me to see you. I've heard that many times in my life. And then here he might say, well, maybe I have it. And over here, he might be saying, well, I have it, but how can I get rid of it? So these are all the different places people come in. Sometimes people come in and they're ready to learn. Every so often that does happen. But a lot of times I see people that look like this dog. I just give up. I don't know what to do. This is so overwhelming. And they are really in a difficult place. So we want to check out where our patients are and start there. That's really important. And we're going to do a lot of assessing, because how they cope with diabetes and their coping strategies and their stress response are based on a lot of different things. What they believe about their health, what they perceive about their health, what is their tradition in their families, what about employment, literacy, cognition, what age are they at? What's a developmental stage? They're going to ask questions about that in the exam. What about their environment? Do they live in a place that's safe to exercise, or do they not like to get out? Do they have a grocery store nearby, or do they have to go shopping at a convenience store? So all of these are part of our assessment, and it's going to help inform us about our approach with that patient. So poll question 2, if a patient is in denial about their diabetes, what is the best approach? So a lot of the questions I'm going to ask today, there's only one right, well, all of the questions, there's only one right answer. And I'm going to keep asking you this, what is the best approach? I am going to ask you these types of questions so you can start seeing that sometimes there may be more than one right answer, but there's only one best answer. That's a big part of this exam, that there is only one best answer. So take a look and vote. Patients in denial, what would we do? Okay, 65% of you have voted. All right, 81. Thanks, you all. I'm just going to close this and show you guys how awesome you are. 85% of you voted, and 100% of you got this right. So you're absolutely right. You want to acknowledge their feelings. We can't make them accept the fact, and we're not going to show them insulin. We're not going to set goals. We're just going to hear what they have to say. So terrific job. All right, great. Let's keep going. So I really love this slide, and I would be familiar with this content. This is by Kubler-Ross, who you know from Death and Grieving, her studies on that, stages of grieving, and Dr. Polonsky, who's very well-known and respected in the diabetes world as far as how people deal with and cope with diabetes. But you can see the different phases of adjustment to diabetes people might be in. And I like this anger. Anger indicates awareness. I actually don't mind anger, because anger has a lot of energy in it, and you can grab that anger and say, it sounds like you're really angry about having diabetes. And the patients are like, I am. I'm like, let's take that anger and move it into action. And anger has a lot of harnessing opportunity, bargaining, you're going to see that group classes are good with this, because you'll see in the group settings, people call each other on stuff. Depression and frustration, they might be realizing that, hey, this isn't going to go away. So we want to provide them with a lot of support and resources. And then people might end up here, accept and adapt. Yeah, I can do this. It's hard. I don't like having diabetes, but I feel pretty confident I can manage it. And guess what? They can be here and accept and adapt and go back to denial. I've seen that many times. They have diabetes for 10 years or just sick of it, and they go, I just don't want to have this disease anymore. And so these are not just, these are not just stages that people are stuck in. They move in and out of them in surprising ways. So we always want to reassess where they're at after we do our initial assessment. And asking questions is part of the art of what we do. And we're going to find out what is really important to you. We're asking the patient these questions. What do you think of your diabetes? We want to find out from their perspective, how are things going? What are their goals? How do you feel about all of this? Probably my most important question. Because if we don't get to the feeling part, how they're coping with it, how they're managing it, how they're emotionally responding to it, we get stuck. So you may think, feelings, those aren't, we don't need to talk about feelings. This is, we need to go over the checklist of diabetes, monitoring low blood sugar, high blood sugar, all that stuff. Yeah, we need to get to that, but we need to figure out how they're responding to it emotionally and see if there's any barriers based on that. And then I really love getting this quote here, get to the why. What motivates you to take care of yourself? What is important in your life? And then we want to find out, help patients identify, what's in it for me? How is doing all this work of diabetes going to benefit me? Because that's ultimately what we want to learn and help the patients identify. We're also going to look at their social support and find out who helps you with your diabetes. Do they help you with practical, do they go grocery shopping or emotional support? And what would you like for support day to day? And how could you get the support you need? And if a lot of the patients I work with don't have very good social support systems, I work with a lot of patients who are newly widowed, live alone, elderly, and so you want to have a resource sheet ready for these, for all your groups of patients. So, here's a number you can call I need Meals on Wheels. Oh, here's a number you can call for a chat line if you need to talk to a friend. So you want to have a resource sheet available to help patients get the resources they need to succeed, especially if they don't have a support system on board that's really helping them. And then this is an interesting slide. What are the types of social support? Well, as diabetes educators, we actually do give a lot of emotional support. And I want to tell you, that's the perceived most important type of support patients receive from us. So I'll notice myself a lot giving emotional support. And over time, I really value that. And the patients value that too, because they feel heard, they feel respected, they feel honored. And that's a gift we give our patients. Informational support is we help them with problem solving. Okay, I hear you wanting to exercise. There's some barriers involved in that. Let's see if we can figure out some strategies to get around those barriers. We provide instrumental support, services, meters, insulin supplies, logbook, and we also provide affirmational support. And these are things like, I'm really impressed that you're keeping a food diary. Or I'm really impressed that on Monday you didn't eat any chips. That was a big goal of yours. Affirmational support, research has really shown it makes a big difference in helping people not only make behavior change, but sustain behavior change. That is way more effective than critiquing patients. So affirmational is, I mean, let's get back to this for a minute because it's a really important point. It's not saying something like, wow, you're a great patient. Wow, you're a superstar. That is not considered affirmational support. Affirmational support looks at behaviors and focuses on patient success with behaviors, acknowledging behavior. You brought in your logbook. Great job. You showed up for your appointment. I'm really impressed you made it. I know it's hard for you to do. That's affirmational. So just focusing on behavioral success is big for patients. So promoting learning and behavior change, we're going to do another poll question. What is the most effective way to teach blood glucose monitoring? What is the most effective? So you can see, again, I'm looking for the best, most effective. There may be more than one right answer. but what's the best? Thanks for voting, everybody. I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close that poll. Thank you so much, and share your results. Okay, so nobody said ask patient to carefully read instructions. Great job. I just had a patient come to see me, and she had a new meter, and they said to her, and she goes, I need training on this meter. And they go, well, don't you know how to read? And she was like, yes. She has a Juris Doctorate, for goodness sake, and they asked her that. So insulting. And so she said, I'm not going to go see that group of people. I'm going to find another team to help me. Okay, send patient home with video instruction. Nobody chose that. Great job, you guys. So now we have C and D. 28% of you chose C, and 72% of you chose D. Let's talk about C. Demonstrate how to use a meter. Okay, so maybe I didn't word that well, so I apologize, but this is like you demonstrate to the patient how to use a meter. So you would show them how to use it and then say, okay, now you know how. That is not the best strategy to teach patients how to do something. When you want to help patients learn how to do something, D is the right answer. You review steps and ask patient for return demonstration. Before the patient leaves your office, you want to make sure they can do it. So the ultimate why this is the best answer, even if I didn't word C that well, is because it has a return demonstration involved. We don't know if patients know how to do things until they show us. And that's a big element of the exam. It's not just, having patients. So we just don't teach patients, oh, these foods have carbohydrates. We need to give patients a sample meal and say, how many grams of carbohydrates are in this meal? They need to demonstrate to us. Here are your medications. What do each of these different medications do? Demonstration to us. So we really want to make sure that the patient is involved in the teaching. So critical for learning. You know that as adult learners, if somebody just shows you how to do something, you forget it in 1 second. Adult learners are self-directed, problem-oriented. They learn better when you incorporate their own experience, and they definitely prefer active participation. And the exam does go over this in a lot of different questions focus on empowerment. It's not us telling the patient what to do. It really assumes that the responsibility of diabetes rests on the patient with the person with diabetes, that the patient is an expert in their own life. We know that they live with diabetes 24/7, 365. They have the most expertise. We're the coach. It posits the empowerment perspective that self-goals are freely chosen, are more successful. They last longer, and it engages the patient in their own self-responsibility. And so I was mentioning before we went online that chapters 1 through 3 in the Art and Science book are really excellent at helping go over a lot of the philosophical underpinnings of the exam and giving really concrete examples on how to approach assessment, how to engage the patient, how to provide education that's meaningful. And so when we're trying to facilitate self-care and specific skill training, we want a demonstration, a return demonstration. We get feedback for their efforts. Just talking about it is less effective. We want action and involvement. Make the behavior real for a patient. Like if you wanted to teach somebody how to ride a bike, you're not just going to stand there and say, well, you put your feet on the pedal and then you turn the pedal and you got to make sure you have good balance. You're not going to tell them. You're going to get them on the bike and have them start doing it. And that's what diabetes education is all about, providing a safe environment for patients to try this out. And this is from Dr. Polonsky again, and it says, you know, no one is unmotivated to lead a long and healthy life. As we're doing our assessment, we're going to look for barriers to success. And there's usually three critical barriers. Number one is the patient doesn't think the behavior is worth it. Like, why should I eat healthily? I'm going to get complications anyway. So we need to let them know that diabetes doesn't mean complications. It's uncontrolled diabetes that leads to complications. So we need to evaluate if they're feeling that. And then, is there too many personal obstacles? Is that person just have too many barriers? Their work, you know, they're busy, they've got family. We need to find out what those obstacles are. And then we're going to look for support and resources. some more on overcoming barriers. A lot of patients have misbeliefs, so we might want to ask them about their beliefs around diabetes, and if they have some information that's not based on fact, we want to just bring that up gently. I love this one, paired glucose testing. Use your meter as a tool. Find out when you eat pizza what happens to your blood sugar. When you exercise, what happens to your blood sugar. And then this question, so great. Tell me one thing that is driving you crazy about your diabetes. If you have a limited time to do a education intervention, this question will get to the nitty-gritty. And I actually ask my patients in the support group just to write down one thing that's driving them crazy about diabetes, and we put it into a hat, and we pulled out those questions, and we did problem solving with each other. It was such a fun activity for them because they have the answers. We just need to help them identify those answers. And the other thing is, we definitely know to improve outcomes, contact patients more often, if that's via phone or by appointments or by support group. That ongoing contact really helps people. So kind of summarizing, we want to reevaluate traditional methods of education, where before we would lecture and the patient would listen. Now we want to help patients explore and identify and accept feelings. And as educators, we want to be mindful and be compassionate and informed listeners. And keep in mind that we don't have to fix the problem. We just have to listen to them, acknowledge them. And when I mean we don't have to fix the problem, I mean we don't have to fix their negative emotions. We will help with fixing problems. They don't have a meter. They need support and resources. And that way we do help with problem solving. But as far as the patient's emotional space, we're going to acknowledge it and help them identify how they want to move forward in their emotional place. Okay, so that's looking at assessment. And throughout the future lectures, we're going to be talking about that, incorporating it into our presentation, and also talk about goal setting too. But now I'd like to spend a big chunk of time on control. Does it really matter? It's really the ultimate questions our patients want to know. Does it matter if I do all this work, or am I going to get complications anyway? So we have a poll question. Which study demonstrated that keeping A1C less than 7% reduces complications for type 1 diabetes? Is it diabetes prevention trial, diabetes control and complications trial, United Kingdom prospective diabetes study, or the youth trial? All right, take a few more minutes. A few more, not minutes, seconds. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. So, do you need to know these landmark trials for the exam? Absolutely, yes, you do. Because these are landmark trials that help us determine, doesn't really matter if we control blood sugars for people with diabetes or pre-diabetes. So the right answer, 72% of you chose that. Good job, team. Diabetes control and complications trial. That is the landmark trial that demonstrated that. And I'm going to go over these other trials too. So the youth trial I just made up. So that was called a juicy answer that I put in there. So there is no trial called a youth trial, but in the exam, they're going to put juicy answers like that. So you just, you know, need to know certain things. And these trials that I'm going to show in the next slides are the trials you just need to memorize. So the first trial, the diabetes prevention program, said, can we stop pre-diabetes from progressing to diabetes? And they looked at 3,000 people with pre-diabetes, and they put them in three different groups. And this is called a prospective trial. So they're going to watch you over time, prospective randomized trial, kind of the cream of the crop of experiments looking at human populations. So they put one-third of the group on placebo, one-third diet and exercise, and one-third of the group on metformin. So there's about 1,000 people in each group, and they watched them for 3 years. And I'm going to tell you something really shocking. That is, in 3 years, the standard group who had no intervention, 30% of them moved on to get diabetes. 30%. And I'm just going to tell you that 79 million people in America right now have prediabetes. So you can see in 3 years, 30% have a risk of moving on. Lifestyle results. Lifestyle reduced risk of developing diabetes by 58%. And if you're over the age of 60, it reduced the risk 71%. Wow, this is shocking. How do we achieve this? Well, 30 minutes of daily activity. So that's, we keep talking about 30 minutes of activity on most days. This is where it came from. And then body weight loss, 5 to 7%. This reduced risk dramatically. I do want to say something very important, however. 14% of the patients still develop diabetes. 14% of the participants still develop diabetes despite having counseling by a dietitian, lifestyle coach, exercise physiologist, research team. They were giving prizes, parades, everything you can imagine to keep them going. So sometimes the genes are just too strong. The patient's not failing. The pancreas is failing. The last group, the metformin group, had a 31% risk reduction. It was less effective with older and thin patients. We know that metformin doesn't work that well when you're older and thinner because they may not be expressing insulin resistance. But this is very important to keep in mind that if you have prediabetes and you take action, you can reduce your risk by 58% or greater through lifestyle change and 31% risk reduction through metformin. This is just for your own information. Every 2.2 pounds of weight loss, the risk of type 2 diabetes was reduced 13%. So in the diabetes prevention program, if you have prediabetes, a little bit of weight loss went a long way. And that's a really important message we want to give to our patients. This is from the American Diabetes Standards of Care. And I hope you've had a chance to start reading that document. It's really important. But they said, have prediabetes. How do you prevent it? Lose 7% of your body weight. Look at this. Eat. Dietitians, I know you're loving this. I love it. I'm not a dietitian. I love it. Everybody loves this slide. Healthy eating, high fiber, low fat. Oh, my gosh. Avoid sugar-sweetened beverages. This is the American Diabetes Association saying this. So now we can say in our classes, and with the stamp of approval, the American Diabetes Association says you should really limit sugar-sweetened beverages. What do I drink? I'm like, what about water? It's been around a long time. Man has relied on it. So we kind of joke around that, and they're like, is water a beverage? I'm like, actually, water is a beverage. So glamming up water is the kind of way to go. Anyways, exercise. Consider metformin therapy. This is really important. If women have a history of GDM, patients with a BMI of 35 or greater, even with prediabetes, if they're under the age of 60. So the American Diabetes Association is saying prediabetes demands attention. Let's help our patients eat more healthily, exercise, and consider metformin for those high-risk group, and definitely monitor cardiovascular risk factors. That's prediabetes. Now let's move on to type 1 diabetes. This is the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial. It was the first landmark study released in 93. I was thrilled about it because I was working in a healthcare situation where people were saying, oh, don't worry about hyperglycemia, only if the patient's symptomatic. And I'm like, really? That doesn't seem right. So we were letting patients run up to 200 blood sugars. But this study said, you know what? That's not right. It's a 10-year study looking at 1,400 subjects with type 1 diabetes. It compared regular treatment versus intensive treatment. And the intensive treatment management, this is important to know because it comes up on the exam sometimes, is that you have to monitor your blood sugar 4 or more times a day, 4 daily insulin injections or insulin pump. And these patients did experience more hypoglycemia and more weight gain. So that was one of the drawbacks because you're getting tighter glucose control, so more hypoglycemia and more weight gain was associated with that. But look at this. If we got the A1C to less than 7% for these type 1s, they reduce the risk of eye, kidney, and nerve disease 50 to 76%. And I put this little graph in here looking at the A1C and microvascular complications. This is relative risk. This is A1C. But this blue line is retinopathy. So retinopathy is kind of our surrogate marker for other vascular complications. So they look for eye disease. And if they start seeing eye disease, that's the indicator that there's other So listen, this is really important. If patients have eye disease, they have other vascular disease throughout their body. So eye disease lets us know that the vasculature is under attack. So they noticed when the A1C got to around 7%, that's when complications really set in. So a lot of times we'll try and push patients to 6 because we know that's the place where there's the least complications, but keeping them less than 7 is very beneficial. And it's based on increased rates of retinopathy relative to A1C. Okay, so that's type 1. What about our type 2s? Well, we have the United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study. This is a huge trial. 5,000 patients, 20 years, and again, a prospective randomized trial, international trial, so difficult to do. But what they did find is a 1% decrease in A1C reduced microvascular complications 35%. And they also really noted that blood pressure control was extremely important. And actually in this study, they suggest that blood pressure control is even more important than blood sugar control to prevent microvascular complications with type 2. So we definitely know with our type 2 patients getting blood sugar and blood pressure to target is very, very important. The legacy effect, and I apologize on this slide in your handout, there's something covering this word, these words, but I did put another PowerPoint presentation where it's not covered up. But the critical point of the legacy effect is that they've been following these participants from the DCCT and UKPDS trial, and they've seen that even though, I'm just going to put this slide up, okay, here's the DCCT participants, and you could see their blood sugars, A1C, very low during treatment, the conventional group, higher A1Cs. And then over time, these two groups merge, and that is the DCCT trial participants, their A1C goes up, and this other group actually was taught how to do more intensive diabetes management after the trial, and their A1C came down. So there was this kind of a convergence of A1Cs. But here's the important thing. This trial showed that even though blood glucose levels increased over time with the study group, they had less microvascular and macrovascular complications. So that the legacy is getting blood sugars close to target early on and maintaining them early on protects patients 10, 20, 30, 40 years out from micro and macrovascular disease. So the message here, catch early, treat aggressively. On average, it takes us 6.5 years to identify diabetes. So we need to do a little bit better on finding patients who are hyperglycemic. Poll question 5. What is a preferred approach when setting goals with patients? Let me launch this. Do we utilize shared decision making? Do we encourage patients to meet national standards? And there's one best answer. Do we highlight the risk of complication when the goals are not met? Or do we focus on the ABCs of diabetes? All right, thanks for voting, everybody. I really, really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. All right, so 70% of you said utilize shared decision making. That is actually the right answer. But let's just look. 4% of you said highlight risk of complications when goals not met. So that's kind of looking at a more fear-based approach. And generally speaking, if you're taking the exam, they really suggest that kind of scaring patients into behavior change doesn't work that well. And then focus on the ABCs of diabetes education. That might be okay, but it's not as good of an answer as utilize shared decision making. So if we just focus on ABCs, oh, John, you need to get the ABCs, A1C, blood pressure, cholesterol, that's a little bit more didactic and just information sharing than saying, you know, John, the A1C goal is this. Let's figure out a strategy how we can get there together. That's shared decision making. So A is the best answer, and 70% of you got that right. Great job. And you know what? If you didn't get it right, it's okay. It's just it's giving you information about how the test, the philosophy of the test is written. So you want to be familiar with that. Because we always want to take a patient-centered approach. This comes from the ADA-EASD position statement, Management of Hyperglycemia in Type 2. It was released a few years ago, and I read this article, and it's on our website, and my mouth fell ajar. I go, what? This is what they wrote in this? This is awesome. And that they said, even in medications, we should provide care that is respectful and responsive to individual patient preferences, needs, and values, ensuring that the patient values guide all clinical decisions. Wow. Okay, so I keep talking about the underlying approach in the exam. This is it. Great summary of the exam. We want to gauge the patient's preferred level of involvement. If they're in denial, we're just going to give them the basics. And we're not going to say you need to check your blood sugar 4 times a day. We may just say, hey, what's the one thing you could work on? And maybe it's not eating ho-hos for breakfast. That might be, you know, a goal we work on with that patient. Explore where possible therapeutic choices so the patient's completely involved in deciding how they want to address medical nutrition therapy, how they want to address medication therapy and exercise. Shared decision making, look at this. Final decisions regarding lifestyle choices ultimately lie with the patient. They do, because they're only with us maybe 1% of their lifetime. The other 99%, they're making that decision. And so I think the shared decision making is really important. So let's talk about the ABCs of diabetes. We know that it matters if what the A1C is, what the blood pressure is, and what the cholesterol is. We know this based on trials. It's evidence-based information. And so we want to pass this on to our patients so they have information to live healthiest life possible while still engaging them in decision-making. It's not always that easy. It's easier for us to say you need to do A, B, and C. But if we do that, patients just nod their head and say yes and walk out the door. So it just takes time to learn how to engage patients and get comfortable doing that. Many of you are, I'm sure, already doing a great job of that. But I'm always learning because I know you all worry about your patients. We want the best for them. And sometimes they make choices we may not agree with. That's really hard for us. But we need to honor and respect that. A1C test. So the A1C test measures glycation of red blood cells over 2 to 3 months. And these are just some really important facts to know for the exam. It's not really an average. It's what we call a weighted mean. And that weighted mean means 50% of the results are from the most recent month. The other 50% are from the previous 2 months. So the most recent month carries 50% of the weight. So it's called a weighted mean. Another important fact to know for your patients and for the exam is that 1% of A1C equals 29 points of blood sugar. Another important thing to know, if the red blood cells are affected by anemia or hemoglobinopathies, they have an unusual shape like sickle cell anemia, or if they're getting a lot of blood transfusions, this test isn't accurate. So we need to be aware of that when we're looking at A1Cs. But the great thing about the A1C is it does measure blood sugar not only in fasting but postprandial state. So it gives us a full picture of what that patient's blood sugar is running 24 hours a day. Great information. And I often refer to this test as the donut test because my patients are like, what's A1C? I don't even understand what that means. Well, I say, if you think about your red blood cells, they're the shape of donuts. And those little donuts, you know, float around in your blood for about 3 months. So if there's a lot of sugar in your blood, what happens to your donuts? They get glazed, right? The more sugar, the more glaze on your donuts. And so I say this test looks to see how glazed are your donuts. And you don't want your donuts to look like Krispy Kreme donuts. I mean, it's actually a really great analogy because that word glycosylated, you know, A1C, we used to call it glycosylated hemoglobin A1C, just means glazed. And in your blood, if there's a lot of sugar, not only do your red blood cells get glazed, so do your proteins and your fats. And it changes the molecular function of those elements in your blood. And they actually lead to inflammation. So it's not good to have a lot of sugar in your blood. It causes a lot of endothelial inflammation and increases the risk for clot formation. So what are the goals? And now I'm talking about the American Diabetes Association, and you may want to know, what should I study, the ADA or other guidelines? So I'm going to give you two organizations you want to be familiar with their goals. And one is the American Diabetes Association. The other one is the AACE. I'll get to them in a minute. But let's just focus on ADA. And in the exam, they might ask you, what are the ADA goals for A1C? And you need to know those. So the goal is less than 7, but look what it says for patients in general. For individual patients, we might try and push it down to 6 without significant hypoglycemia. So I'm not going to push a frail elderly patient with diabetes living by herself to an A1C of 6. I'm not going to do it. But if I have a young type 1 who's very involved, got good social support, doesn't have a high risk of hypoglycemia, I'm going to say, let's try and get your A1C as close to 6 as possible. The goals are based on how long they've had diabetes, a life expectancy, do they have any other comorbidities, cardiovascular complications. We need to individualize this goal. So this goal is not written in stone. We're going to push it closer to 6 for some patients. It's 7 in general, but very important is that we might let it go all the way up to 8 for certain patient populations. Those with a history of hypoglycemia, limited life expectancy, and this comes from the ACCORD trial where they tried to push A1Cs to 6% in these patients who are frail, elderly, with a lot of cardiovascular complications. And they actually ended up increasing their rate, their mortality rate went up. And so we had to pause and say, why did the mortality rate go up? Maybe it's not such a good idea to push high-risk patients' A1C to 6%. And so we always have to evaluate the benefit versus the cost and how will it benefit this patient. So a lot of my frail elderly patients were running in the mid-7s, and that's okay. It's okay. I had a patient come in to see me the other day, and he goes, Bev, I don't have diabetes. I have borderline diabetes. And whenever you hear that, what are you thinking? Yeah, probably denial. And so I said, really, John, what's your A1C? He's like, well, my A1C is 12.2. And so I have my little chart, and I said, yeah, that's interesting, because when you see this A1C of 12.2, it means average blood sugars are running 298. And generally, people without diabetes have A1Cs right around here, 6%, or average blood sugar of 126. And I just let that sit there for a minute. And that was a really eye-opening moment for him, and he was able to kind of take the next step forward in dealing with his diabetes. I do want to say that you can order these sheets from the American Diabetes Association for free, and they're fantastic. I use them at every appointment because it gives the patients a place to know where they're at and where we were trying to get to. The American Diabetes Association also has goals for pre-meal blood sugars, 70 to 130, and post-meal, less than 180. This is for non-pregnant adults. These are goals that I talk a lot about with my patients, but I do say again, if I have a frail elderly patient, I don't want them waking up at 70 in the morning. I'm going to change that goal to 100 to 130. I'm going to adjust these goals. We personalize these goals. If I have a patient running 400 and they come in to see me, I'm not going to say you need to get your blood sugar less than 130. I'm going to say let's just get it less than 300 and then 200. So these goals are just a reference point, but good to know for the exam. Okay. According to the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, AACE, what is the A1C goal? So they have different goals than the ADA, and let's see if you're familiar with that. So don't look ahead in your handouts if at all possible, even though I know the temptation is there. Okay, thank you everyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results. Okay, so according to the AACE, what is the A1C goal? Now, if you don't know anything about this or what the answer is, I just want to tell you about the first answer, less than 6.5 for all patients. Anytime you see an answer that says the word all, every, always, it's usually wrong because we need to make room for flexibility and for personalization and individualization. So I kind of put that in there as a juicy answer to help remind me to tell all of you, I just use the word all, but to tell all of you that if the answer says all, always, never, it's usually wrong because we're dealing with human element, and humans, we need to be flexible and we need to adjust based on what that person presents. So A is the wrong answer. And now B, I put another juicy answer in there too. The question asks, so you always want to match the intent of the question and the answer. So the question asks, what is the goal for A1C? And it's not asking for pre-male blood glucose. So that's just a good reminder to double check. What's the intent? What's the answer? Do they match? So B is wrong. And C, A1C less than 7, that isn't the right answer either. But guess what? 65% of you got the answer right. Great job, everybody. A1C less than 6.5 for healthy patients. How would you know that is what you're saying to me. Well, guess what? On your resource page, I did put the slides, which is a quick summary of the AACE guidelines, and I also put the very lengthy and detailed article. And so you want to review that before the exam and be familiar with it. A1C goal is less than 6.5, less or equal to, for healthy patients without concurrent illness and at low risk for hypo. A1C more than 6.5 for patients who have concurrent illness or at risk for hypo. And on this slide, I also added their pre-meal goal is less than 110, post-meal goal for blood sugar, less than 140. So they have different goals. And so you might ask me, you know, which goals do we use in practice? Well, here's my strategy. I use the ADA goals initially, and if patients are reaching those and I feel safe with them and they feel like they want to move forward, we'll move on to the AACE goals. The AACE goals, more stringent. ADA goals are more global. ADA goals are saying, gosh, we know that we're only meeting these goals 50% of the time. Let's not make them so hard for people to achieve. AACE says we're clinical endocrinologists. We want to get that A1C less than 6.5 for most of our patients. So they just have different perspectives. Okay, what about blood pressure? Blood pressure goal, you all know this. It's recently changed, and it used to be 130 over 80. But what they said is, hey, we're not getting any better outcomes pushing it to 130 over 80, and we're getting more orthostatic hypotension, and there's more complications associated with that. So let's just look at the evidence and base our recommendations on the evidence. It does say here that some patients who have a history of cardiovascular disease may benefit from a lower blood pressure. But the number one thing we always do to help lower blood pressure is lifestyle first. What is lifestyle? Exercise, losing weight, talking to the dietitian, maybe looking at a DASH diet, looking at salt intake, all of that stuff. So lifestyle, number one, but if we don't reach our target, we're going to have to add blood pressure medications. And you can see I've listed here first-line blood pressure drugs, the ACE inhibitors, the ARBs. We usually start with one of those, and then to potentiate either of those, we'll add a diuretic. And you know, many patients with type 2 diabetes need two or more antihypertension medications. And on your resource page, as I mentioned, I have a lot of detailed information on blood pressure medications and also lipid medications. Do you need to memorize those pages? No, but I would read. I have little paragraphs describing those medications and some considerations, and I'm going to highlight main things to keep in mind in these future slides. But detecting hypertension, this is kind of a pet peeve of mine because when I go to the doctor, they never check my blood pressure right. I'm running in, they check my blood pressure, they don't wait for me to be still, for 5 minutes, and thank goodness I don't have hypertension. But always I tell my patients about this, make sure you sit still. They use a blood pressure cuff that fits you because you want to make sure they're getting accurate readings, and they do have to repeat it on a separate day to confirm diagnosis of hypertension. So the ACE inhibitors, I'm just going to go through these rather quickly and just talk about main points to know. For all blood pressure medications, we definitely want to try and give them at the same time every day. Some recent studies suggest maybe giving it at nighttime is better to kind of match the circadian rhythm. But whatever patients do, just take it, start low dose, same time every day, and then the dose is gradually upregulated or updosed so patients achieve blood pressure control. And we know to tell patients, if your blood pressure is at target, it doesn't mean you stop the medication. It means the medication is working. And you're probably going to need to be on this blood pressure medication for the long haul. And so with the ACE inhibitors, so that's just general. And the other general thing I want to mention right now is orthostatic hypotension. So patients are getting up and they're feeling faint. That may be a sign their blood pressure medication, they're on too much and their blood pressure is going too low. I let all of my patients know to report that to their provider, especially as we start working with patients and they lose weight, exercise more, change the way they eat, their blood pressures drop from their lifestyle changes. So many times their medication dose needs to be adjusted. And for all these blood pressure medications, we definitely keep an eye on electrolytes and kidney function. We want to make sure the kidneys are working well when patients take these meds because they can affect kidney function. So that's really important to know. But for the ACE inhibitors, cough is the big thing. Cough, cough, cough. So it's just a little dry cough. And what we'll do if we identify that is switch them to a different ACE inhibitor. And if that doesn't work, we might have to try a different class of meds. So the ARBs, great data on them, helping patients with type 2 diabetes in particular to reduce their risk of cardiovascular events. And again, dosing once daily, same time every day, looking at electrolytes, and looking for orthostatic hypotension. Beta blockers. These are really designed for patients with diabetes who have had an MI or have concurrent cardiac problems. We dose those once or twice a day. We always want to get to the lowest dose and don't stop them without consulting your provider. It can cause a hypertension crisis. So these medications, beta blockers, block the beta adrenergic response. And so if patients are on insulin or sulfonylureas and they get a low blood sugar, they may not get strong signs of hypoglycemia. Can block signs of low blood sugar, including tachycardia. But I've had two patients so far that were on beta blockers and they got low blood sugar right in front of my eyes. And the way they knew that they had low blood sugar is they sweat it profusely. So they can still sweat even though they're on a beta blocker, and that's how they know they're low. But they are definitely going to have to monitor their blood sugar more frequently to make sure they're not going low, and they may not be able to detect it as quickly. Beta blockers. Diuretics, again, looking for electrolyte imbalances, muscle cramp from dehydration, because sometimes patients are on too much. And so these are just important to know that oftentimes we use an ACE or ARB plus a diuretic, and that seems to be a really good combination for patients with diabetes. Okay, let's talk a little bit about lipid goals. So these are just, this is information we just have to memorize. So the lipid goal is LDL less than 100, but if the patient has a high risk of cardiovascular disease, we want that LDL, also known as lousy or lethal cholesterol, less than 70. The HDL, the happy or healthy cholesterol, we just generally say more than 40, and triglycerides less than 150. We do also say if we have patients on statin therapy and we can't get those lipids to goal, let's just lower it by 40%. So sometimes we just can't reach those targets, but we are going to try and at least lower it. So lipid management always starts with lifestyle interventions. You all know this. Reducing saturated and trans fats, exercise, more fiber, stop smoking, lose weight, all of that's going to help. But most patients with diabetes need a statin. So the ADA says, add statins for patients regardless of LDL. This is really important. If they have heart disease or without heart disease, who are 40 years and older and have one CVD risk factor. So if they smoke, if they have hypertension, if they have other heart disease risk factors. So you'll see that most people with diabetes are on a statin, and the research supports that people on statins with diabetes, it does lower cardiovascular events and mortality. The number one cause of death from people with diabetes is heart attack and stroke. So LDL is our first goal. We want to get that down. We want to try and crank up HDL through exercise weight loss. We might use niacin. It's kind of out of favor now because it didn't seem to reduce mortality, even though it might lower, even though it might help increase HDL, it didn't seem to be worth it for a lot of the patients as far as improving outcomes. Triglyceride lowering, glycemic control is really number one for that. As you get blood sugars down, we'll see those triglycerides come down. So for statins, what's the main thing we need to know? You guys know this. It's that rhabdomyolysis, muscle pain, looking for elevated liver enzyme, muscle aches, and memory loss. So patients may not be able to think as clearly. That could be from a statin. So I'm always on the lookout from that if they start complaining of that. And also there was a study that came out that it increased the rate of hyperglycemia in people without diabetes. And so what they found out is that it does increase the rate by about 0.05%, and it tends to cause hyperglycemia and people who are already at risk for diabetes anyways. So they determined that the benefit outweighs the risk. So statins, we're going to monitor liver function and have any muscle aches reported right away. I'm going to just keep moving past niacin and just spend a few minutes on aspirin therapy. Aspirin therapy, as you know, people with diabetes are more likely to have clots and cardiovascular events, a stroke and heart attack. So they do recommend aspirin use if the man is over 50 and women are over 60 who smoke or have a cardiovascular risk factor. And so that's kind of the age range you want to keep in mind when we start it. Starting it earlier seem to cause problems because, as you know, aspirin increases the risk of bleeding. So you want to let our patients know to report any signs of bleeding associated with aspirin. Smoking and diabetes. Wow, this is a painting by Van Gogh. Even before we knew the complications of smoking, smoking is deadly. Smoking increases the risk of diabetes 30%, and if you do smoke, it causes a lots of problems as far as circulation, increased risk for amputation, bladder cancer, circulation, heart attack, stroke. You guys know all that. So in Brazil, this is the new cigarette packaging they have, which I think is really terrific. And so you're a guy, you're out at a bar, you're smoking, and this is what's on your cigarette package. Guess what? Smoking went down in Brazil. So I'm really anxious for America to get on that bandwagon. Let's take a look at the 78-year-old man. He smokes a pack per day. His A1C was 8.1, which, so we have to look at this in relative terms. It was 10.4%. He's really trying to bring it down. His blood pressure, 136 over 76. His morning blood glucose levels, 100. 2-hour postprandial, 190s. Here's his cholesterol. You can see his LDL is 98, HDL 46, triglycerides 54. His meds include insulin, benazepril, metoprolol, warfarin, and Actos. Based on the ADA guidelines that we've just gone over, I'm going to launch a poll here. This is a good self-study. Go through all of those and figure out what class of medication is that patient on? Do we want to provide any special instruction? And my question I want to ask you, is any medication missing from his profile? So just take a minute to vote on that. Okay, take a few more seconds. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. Thanks, you guys, for voting. Before we reveal the answers, let's just go over what class of medications this patient's on. He's on insulin, which is insulin. He's on benazepril, which is an ACE inhibitor. He's on metoprolol, which is a beta blocker. He's on warfarin, which is a blood thinner. And Actos, which is a thiazolidinediol, so it will help increase insulin sensitivity. So based on this, is there any special instructions? Well, yeah, he's on a beta blocker and insulin, so we know that he may not get strong signs of low blood sugar, so we're going to make sure that he is aware that signs of low blood sugar and he's checking his blood sugar on a regular basis. But my main question is any med missing? And let's just share this with everyone. So let's look at his risk. Does he have a high risk for cardiovascular disease? Yes, he does. He's 78. He smokes a pack a day. And his LDL is 98. So remember what the guidelines said? Even if the LDL is less than 100, if they have a cardiovascular risk factor, start a statin. So the right answer here, and 73% of you got this right, was a statin. This man, from his history and this information we have, really needs to be on a statin to reduce his cardiovascular disease risk. So I'm going to go ahead and hide this. So these are just, I don't know if they would ask this type of question on the exam. It's a little bit, you know, complicated, but it's just good to know the basic medications that people need to be on based on the ADA standards. Okay, so here's another slide you definitely kind of want to memorize, and that is, what are the tests that people with diabetes need and how often do they need them? This is interesting. The A1C is not every 3 months. It's at least twice a year. So everybody's different. If their A1C is running 13.8, we're going to check it more frequently. But what if their A1C is always 6.2? We can check it twice a year. Blood pressure, each visit. Cholesterol, yearly, less if normal. Again, let's not overdo things if we don't need to do it. Weight, microalbuminuria, GFR, creatinine, yearly eye exam, yearly dental care at least twice a year, foot exam, physical activity, preconception counseling as needed. Any woman of childbearing age and any man of childbearing age needs preconception counseling because you want to make sure before you move into getting pregnant or raising a family that your blood sugars are in excellent control. Vaccines, immunizations, very important. Flu vaccine for all people, but diabetes is especially important starting at 6 months of age. Pneumococcal vaccine starting at 2 years, and they might need a revaccination after 64. A new recommendation by the CDC, Hep B vaccine for diabetes patients 19 to 59 because they have double the risk of hepatitis B due to lancing devices. So, wow, a lot of work. So these are the ABCs of diabetes. You want to be familiar with these. You want to make sure your patients are aware of these. And I always send with my patients these goals and where their blood sugars, blood pressure, and lipids are in relation to these goals to start a dialogue with their provider. The more a patient is involved, the more likely they are to succeed. Let's take a look at Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones is 62 years old with newly diagnosed type 2. He has a history of a previous MI. Here's his medications, Lasix and Synthroid. His A1C is 9.3. So just think to yourself, what's the target for him? Less than 7, you're right. His HDL is 37. That's a healthy cholesterol. We want that more than 40. His LDL is 156. He has a history of a previous MI. What should his target be? Less than 70. Triglycerides are 260. That's above target. We want those less than 150. We did a dipstick for urine protein, and we found that was negative. That's not good enough. He needs microalbuminuria testing, and he also needs GFR. How's his blood pressure? 142 over 92. It's above target. We want to get that 140 over 80. So we know this patient really needs what I would say a lot of love because his A1C is above target, his LDL is above target, his blood pressure is above target. I'm very worried about a cardiovascular event. So what you might want to do after we end this session is think about what medications do you think this patient would benefit from and what self-care skills would he benefit from. He's walking the dog around the block 3 times a week. Is that exercise? Yes, it is. It's terrific, but maybe he can benefit from a little bit more. So you just want to be familiar with what the targets are and then how do we get there. And the thing about our patients, as we look at their results and the treatment goals aren't being met, we definitely want to consider diabetes distress. Maybe they're overwhelmed by their diabetes. Maybe they don't have good social support. Maybe there's some barriers we haven't identified. And getting patients involved in diabetes self-management, education, and support programs is very important. I think only 10% of patients see registered dietitians. Only 30 to 40% of patients get into diabetes self-management education programs. And they should be going there because studies show, evidence shows that when people go to these programs, they lower their A1C 1 to 2 percentage point, better quality of life, better coping, lower costs for medications, and they have improved outcomes. So if you don't work within a diabetes self-management education program, you might want to be listen to that webcast I have on setting up a successful diabetes program, because it talks about the elements that are involved, how we measure outcomes, and the steps that are involved in setting up a program. And there will be questions on the exam about self-management, education, and support. So that would be a good online course for you to review. Well, for the last 30 minutes, we have 25 minutes or so, we're going to talk about low blood sugar and we're going to talk about hospitalization and monitoring. So when I think about hypoglycemia, I consider it the limiting factor. We can bring blood sugars down to a point, but once we get too aggressive, patients are more likely to have severe hypoglycemia and run into trouble. So we can only push those blood sugars so low. 50% of low blood sugar episodes happen during the night, so we want to prepare our patients for that, and we want to make sure they go to bed with blood sugars at target range before they go to sleep, and that they have their meter by their bed, and they have a snack by their bed if they're at risk for hypoglycemia. Very important, because they may not be able to make it to the fridge. And a lot of people, patients, I ask, what medications are you on? And maybe they say, well, I'm on this blue pill or this little pink pill or this little white pill. And they don't know if that's the sulfonuria. Sulfonurias are really culpable in causing hypoglycemia, especially gliburide. In the ADA position statement in this article I read recently, they were saying that gliburide really should not be used because it causes issues. It causes more hypoglycemia, and it also inhibits this cardiac preconditioning, which actually protects your heart against heart attacks and problems and stress. So they recommend instead using the other sulfonurias, which we'll go over in a future class in more detail. But anyways, the blood glucose level doesn't describe the severity. It's the response is individual. Some patients may feel very low when their blood sugar is 90, and some patients may not even feel it till they're 50. So patients run on this continuum based on what their blood sugars run on a normal basis. But definitely keeping in mind when we work with patients, what are some clinical risk factors for hypoglycemia? If they're on sulfonurias, intensive insulin, if their kidneys or liver are not working that well, kidneys especially help clear used insulin and used medications. So if the kidneys are impacted, those medications and insulin may stay in a lot longer. If they're older and not eating on a regular basis, this is interesting. If the A1C is near normal, so if I have a guy whose A1C is 5.9, we go, wow, that's terrific. But I'm worried because I know he's getting low blood sugars, especially if they're on insulin therapy, intensive insulin therapy. Well, if he's just on metformin, I'm not that worried about low blood sugars. But if they're on insulin or sulfonurias and their A1C is 5.9, I'm looking at that logbook to see where they're getting the low. If they have neuropathy, they're more likely to get lows and not detect it. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But I just want to point out this other bullet point, which is really important. If they have a history of frequent lows, they're more likely in the future to have frequent lows. They're high-risk patients. We need to evaluate what medication and what food they're eating and their activity level to help prevent that hypo in the future. So here's the glycemic thresholds. And you can see when you're in that lower euglycemia. So euglycemia just means you're in that sweet spot. Your blood sugar is good, 80 to 90s. You're still having a little bit of endogenous insulin available to you. But as your blood sugars run toward the 70s, you start releasing other hormones. They're called stress hormones or corticosteroid hormones that actually try and raise your blood sugar. So you're going to start releasing glucagon and adrenaline. When you're in the 60s, you're going to release this growth hormone and cortisol. And now you're starting to exhibit these signs of hypoglycemia, but your body's trying to compensate by releasing these other hormones to raise your blood sugar by telling your liver to liberate glucose. By the time you're in the 40s, you reach this place where you can't think that well. It's called cognitive deterioration or neuroglycopenia. So this is a crisis situation because a patient may not be able to think, I need food, I need to eat. They may just not be able to even pull their thoughts together. And here you can see early signs of low blood sugar, anxiety, palpitations, sweating, all of this. So when I'm meeting with patients and talking about low, what I'll say is I don't go over this list. I say, tell me your signs of low. Because each one of you listening to me right now has your own particular manifestation of hypoglycemia. My manifestation is grouchy. I get really cranky and I can't think straight when I'm low. So if a patient tells you that, you say, when you feel that way, what are you going to do? You're going to eat. And then you may say, well, Bev, what about checking your blood sugar? Well, I want you to eat first, because what if your blood sugar is going lower and you can't figure out how to use your meter? That is dangerous. Eat, then check, because I don't want you to run into neuroglycopenia. The other thing we're always on the lookout for is nocturnal hypoglycemia. So these are patients who get low during the middle of the night. We don't check our blood sugar in the middle of the night. So how do we know? Well, patients might wake up with vivid dream, headaches, night sweats, wake up hungry, or sometimes their blood sugars might be high in the morning. They had rebound hyperglycemia, also known as Somogyi effect. And so if patients start reporting this, we need to evaluate what their medication regimen is, and are they getting too much medication before they go to bed. And so you could say to me, well, Bev, maybe they should eat more before they go to bed. But if you eat more before you go to bed, you might gain weight. Most people don't want to gain weight, so I'd rather cut back on medication. The other thing we know with diabetes that's so it's just heartbreaking to me is that many of our patients with type 1 lose their ability to detect hypoglycemia. So it's called hypoglycemia unawareness. They become unaware their blood sugars are too low. These are patients who have blood sugars 50s and 40s, and they feel fine. They're still talking. They're still interacting. Because what's happened is they don't make enough adrenaline to get that shaky, sweaty, cold, clammy feeling. They've lost their adrenaline response or epinephrine response, and they also have limited glucagon secretion. You know, on your pancreas, you have alpha cells that make glucagon, and beta cells that make insulin. Well, as the pancreas is destroyed, the alpha cells also get destroyed. So if you don't make enough glucagon, you don't have a response to low blood sugar. And so these patients are at very high risk from passing out from low blood sugar and from death from low blood sugar. I hate to say it, but it's true. So we need to identify who these patients are and help them prevent lows. Some of these patients have now continuous glucose monitoring to identify lows and alarm if they're running low, life-saving. Some of these patients get diabetes dogs to detect if they're low. And so you want to identify who these patients are and get them the resources they need to prevent severe and life-threatening hypoglycemia. I do want to mention one other thing is there's lots of studies that show if patients lose their sense of low blood sugar and become hypoglycemia unaware, if they can keep their blood sugars above 100 for a few months, and many times they don't want to do this, they're too afraid of complications, but if they can just stick with it and keep that blood sugar above 100, they can oftentimes regain some of their sensation of hypoglycemia. Very important to share with our patients, and that's from the work of Philip Cryer, C-R-Y-E-R. He did a lot of research on regaining the sensibility of low blood sugar and keeping the blood sugar around above 90 to 100 for a while can really help patients. Okay, the other thing we might want to tell our patients is keep a diary. Because I've had patients who say, I don't feel any symptoms of low blood sugar. I'm like, we got to identify something to save your life, right? So I have patients keep diaries when they get low, of course, after they eat, to identify any signs. And this one patient could identify he got twitching of his lip. A lot of patients get numbness around their mouth. So whatever it is, man, we're going to take it. treatment of low, you know this. If the blood sugar is less than 70, 10 to 15 grams of carb, and then test in 15 minutes. If it's still low, treat again. Follow with usual snack or meal. Severe hypoglycemia requires the assistance of others. So this patient, they're unconscious. They've passed out from low blood sugar. What we can do is, maybe a loved one, if they find them, they could put honey inside the cheek, or they could put some corn syrup, icing gel. But the gold standard is a glucagon emergency kit. If they're in the hospital, we give D50. So the glucagon emergency kit, if they're an adult, 1 milligram, we give the entire dose. But for kids, we give half the dose. And this question does appear on the exam, or it has in the past. So the glucagon emergency kit, we give the complete dose for adults, half for the kids if they're under 20 kilograms. And you can see that the effect is short-lived. You're just releasing all the glycogen stores from the liver, so they need to eat as soon as they can after they get the glucagon. We've just depleted the liver of all of its glycogen stores. They don't want to eat after they get this because they're oftentimes nauseated. They might vomit, but we need to get something down them to get those blood sugars up. And here's an example of a glucagon emergency kit. It's single use only. And when patients are getting it, it requires a prescription. And make sure it's not expired because the shelf life can be short, especially if they get one that's been in the pharmacy for a while. So ask the pharmacist to reach way in the back and get the one that has the longest expiration date. So preventing low blood sugar is an important part of what we do as diabetes educators. We're going to look at if our patient is at risk. If they are, we're going to look at that logbook, identify when they're at risk for getting low, and help them make changes to protect against it. And a lot of patients don't understand that increased activity really can affect your blood sugar into the night. Like I had patients who are raking this time of year, raking a lot of leaves. That can cause nocturnal hypoglycemia. So be aware of that. Adjust your food intake to accommodate that. As diabetes educators and healthcare professionals, we're going to monitor kidney function and weight changes. Patients who lose weight and exercise more need less medication. Let's be a collaborator with a provider and make suggestions for decreasing these medications. Alcohol can cause low blood sugar. We'll talk about that more in the future, but these are just strategies that we want to help identify with our patients to prevent low blood sugar. So for the remaining time, let's talk a little bit about monitoring, sick day management, and hospital goals. So let's identify some barriers to monitoring and ways to overcome it and look at patients in the hospital setting. So self-monitoring, why should I do it? We're asking patients, they come into the hospital or they're in the outpatient setting, they've got this new diagnosis of diabetes, and now on top of it, we're going to ask them to poke their finger and check their blood sugar once to, 5 times a day. So the patients are going to want to know what's in it for me, the ultimate question. And we need to have a response ready for them. And I say, you know what? It's to evaluate if the plan is working. You check your blood sugars not to see whether or not you're failing, but to see if the plan is working. And the plan consists of three things: your exercise, your food intake, and your medications. And if your blood sugars aren't reaching target, we need to adjust one of those. And then above and beyond that, you're going to feel better every day. You have more of a sense of control. Less likely to be hospitalized, missing work is less likely. You won't get into a situation when your blood sugar's too low. I was teaching class the other day, and a patient was sitting right there in my class, and she got severe low blood sugar. And so thank goodness I had snacks in my bag. I gave her some snacks. So staying on top of the blood sugar by monitoring it, looking for trends, can really be helpful. The other thing is unwanted weight gain. By checking your blood sugars, you'll see that you may need less medication. Your blood sugars are closer to target than you thought. So let's cut back on your medication to help avoid weight gain. So how will it help me? See if your plan is working. And I love this. Find out how that pizza affected your blood sugar. So patients will often say, well, I can't eat Chinese food now, or I can't have pizza, or I can't eat rice. I've got diabetes. And I'm like, let's do this test. It's called paired glucose testing. Check your blood sugar before you eat that meal, and then have that meal, and then check your blood sugar 2 hours later. See what happened to your blood sugar. Maybe you can eat pizza, but not quite as much. Or maybe you want to load on the vegetables on your pizza and eat a little bit less. And maybe when you go out for Chinese, focus more again on vegetables or not getting the sweet and sour choices, maybe choosing other things that don't affect your blood sugar as much. So here's the deal. People live with diabetes 24/7, 365. We want to help them integrate it into their lifestyle and not feel like it's such a burden and it's taking away all their fun. So how often should I check? Be realistic. If you work in the hospital setting, we're checking patients' blood sugars 4 times a day. But in the outpatient setting, patients may not need to check as much. If they're on type 2 diabetes on oral medication, Medicare only covers 100 strips for 3 months. 100 strips. So that means one poke a day. So if they can only check once a day, what is the best time to check? And for a lot of my patients, I'm going to base that on their medications, on their activity level, on their goals, and so forth. But in general, if I can just have one check a day, I'm going to ask the patient to check in the morning before breakfast, or in the evening 2 hours after dinner. So I might say, why don't you just check for 1 week before breakfast and 1 week 2 hours after dinner? Or maybe Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday you do the morning and the other days you do after dinner. I don't care, but I want to see if you're, like, you can do it whatever way you want, but I want to get different times of the day to see what your blood sugar does morning in the fasting, because that tells me how well your liver worked. It tells me what your liver did overnight and how well your insulin is keeping your liver under control. And then 2 hours after dinner tells me how well your pancreas is working in relation to food, and it tells me about the carbohydrate intake. Do we need to adjust that a little bit? So the American Diabetes Association guidelines say for some patients we may want to monitor, especially our type 1s, before meals, snacks, and at bedtime, occasional postprandial and before exercise, and if patient suspects a low, after treating the low blood sugar, let's check it to make sure they're coming back up. Very important to check before critical tasks such as driving. In our community, many patients have gotten accidents secondary to severe hypoglycemia, so really knowing what your blood sugar is before you get behind a wheel. Be practical. No 2 patients or 2 days are alike. So we want to really base it on the patient. And the other thing is, if patients are overburdened and checking too much, they burn out. So as far as teaching about glucose monitoring, we want to make sure they do a return demonstration. They're safe in doing it. They know how to use it. And we want to make sure they know how proper care for their meter and their strips, how to properly dispose of lancets. So in your state, you need to know the regulations, but like in California, no patient can throw their lancet in the trash. They're a lawbreaker. They have to put it in a sharps container. And that's the best advice. Put your sharps, your insulin needles, and your lancets in a sharps container and dispose of it in a hazardous waste disposal site. The 1-800 number on the back of the meter is very important, because sometimes patients get stuck. They think their machine is broken. Call that number. They will walk them through. It's free. They're available. Use that. And on the exam, they oftentimes ask, what's the most common reason for inaccurate results? It's mostly user error. It is true that these meters can be off 10%, too low or too high. That's still acceptable. But most of the big errors come from patients doing it incorrectly. What about alternate site testing? So alternate site testing says, let's use the palm of your hand, your upper arm, or your upper leg to get a blood sample. When is it okay to use alternate testing? If there's no risk of hypoglycemia, if the blood sugars are stable, but if the blood sugar is less than 90, recheck on a finger to make sure. Alternate site testing may not be as accurate when the blood sugar is fluctuating. So we use that when things are stable and the patients are really suffering from finger fatigue. Times we would not use alternate site testing: pregnant, intensive insulin, during low blood sugar, and during illness. I do want to mention this whole monitor talk issue, because a lot of my patients don't want to check their blood sugar because they're afraid of their results. They especially don't want to check their blood sugar at night because, or after they eat. They're afraid it's going to be too high. So I work a lot with them on this thing called monitor talk, and avoid judging your glucose levels as good or bad. And as an educator, I really avoid saying, "Wow, these are great blood sugars," or "Wow, this blood sugar is really high." Because then the patient, I'm making a judgment on their blood sugar. So I use terms like, "Oh, your blood sugar is above target," or "Oh, your blood sugar is right in target." "Oh, your blood sugar is below target." So I use emotionally neutral language, and I help them internalize that. And then you want to say stuff like this. You want to, when patients bring in the logbook, number one, focus on the work that they're doing. "I am really impressed you are checking your blood sugar once a day and writing it down." Okay? We want to acknowledge their work. And then this is using curiosity for when you ask questions. "I'm curious to learn what's helping you succeed with blood sugar testing. If a patient had a hard time checking and all of a sudden they're succeeding, find out how they're succeeding and how we can keep this up." And then here's another one. "What if they're not checking? I'm interested to see you are skipping some days. Can you share more about that?" Wow. What a better way of asking the question instead of, "Hey, how come you're not checking your blood sugar?" You see what I'm saying? Because you're asking with curiosity and respect. So those are just some strategies to ask patients about blood sugar and get some answers. Let's do a poll question. We're going to talk about sick days, and then we'll move on. What is the best sick day recommendation? Sorry about that. Is anybody out there getting neuroglycopenic right now? Because it's right around lunchtime, but maybe from the East Coast you already ate. Let's launch this question. So is it to stop all diabetes medications, test blood glucose every 2 hours, continue to take diabetes medication, or only drink sugar-free beverages? So this is the best answer, the best answer. And there's only one right one. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Thank you so much, everyone, for voting. So you all did great because you didn't choose stop all diabetes medications. That's the right answer, and it has the word all in it, so you know it's probably wrong. So nobody else chose only drink sugar-free beverages. Again, only. See, so that's exactly right. But you did, there was some controversy here. Check blood sugar every 2 hours or continue to take diabetes medication. So what is the best sick day recommendation? And the best recommendation is continue to take your diabetes medications, because the recommendations for checking are check at least every 4 hours. So I rather have somebody keep taking their medications. That is the most important thing, because most patients who come to the hospital in hyperglycemic crisis due to being sick are there because they stopped their medications. So continue taking medications. We may need to adjust up or down. Test glucose every 4 hours, and if you're too sick, you can't do that. So we need to make sure they have a support person who will help with that. Plan ahead and contact the provider if you are sick, and here's some reasons to call your doctor if you're sick. Vomiting, diarrhea, of course, difficulty breathing. You can't get those blood sugars down, or your temperature is greater than 101, or you have ketones in your urine. So good reasons to let our patients know. And then what if they are admitted to the hospital? Does it matter? Do we have to control their blood sugar in the hospital setting? What's the big deal? And I want to say, of course, yes. In the old days, we didn't really care that much about inpatient blood glucose control. We said, you know, it's just a short time. It doesn't really matter. But we know that when patients have high blood sugar in the hospital, they have more chance of MI, stroke, infection, and have longer lengths of stay and higher mortality and morbidity rates. So when we admit a patient to the hospital, we're going to look at their blood sugar levels. And if their blood sugar levels fasting are 100 to 125, That means they have prediabetes. And if their fasting is 126, random 200 or greater, or their A1C is 6.5, that means they have diabetes. So you may say, well, that's, of course their blood sugars are high, they're in a stress state, but there's a lot of patients in the hospital whose blood sugars are normal, even though they're in a stress state. So the deal is that hospitalization and illness are pancreatic stress tests. It shows us how well that pancreas is working, and if the pancreas can't do the job, we'll see hyperglycemia. And this is from Dr. Umpiedes et al. Any blood glucose above 140, whether or not the patient is diagnosed with diabetes, requires treatment. And what should we aim for in the hospital setting? Well, for critically ill patients, if they're more than 180, we start insulin and we keep them at 140 over 180. For non-critically ill patients, we have very similar goals as outpatient, pre-meal less than 140, post-meal less than 180. Insulin therapy is a preferred treatment, and the American Diabetes Association 2014 Standards of Care says on admission, stop oral agents on admission, and don't just use sliding scale. It's discouraged. What they say is start basal bolus insulin therapy, and we'll be talking about that in an upcoming session. And if patients are getting ready for surgery, we definitely want to try and schedule surgery in the morning and resume medication or insulin when stable, and make sure that if they're going to surgery, hold the morning medication. If they're on basal insulin for type 2, give 50 to 100% of the usual AM basal dose. For type 1s, they need basal insulin. We usually recommend giving 100%, and they might need a little bit of bolus insulin if their blood sugars are above target. But definitely monitoring them during anesthesia is really important. And I'm just talking about online courses to review. Of course, this is a boot camp. We're just getting to the nitty-gritty of the most critical things to know. So we do have a course on hyperglycemic crisis that looks at DKA, HHS, and steroid-induced hyperglycemia. We do have an online class, Setting Up a Successful Diabetes Program. And then we have another program on chronic complications. So these are different online courses that you can use to help prepare for this exam, and I would encourage you, if that's not your area of strength, to go ahead and listen to those and check them out. So it's 12, let's see, it's actually exactly 1 o'clock, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. I know you have some lingering questions. I do want to encourage you to take a look at the standards of care, and then within the standards of care, there are glucose goals for kids and during pregnancy. Those are additional goals you want to know as part of your preparation for the exam, and I also do cover those goals in the online courses. So as usual, I'm going to sign off and stop the recording button, but I encourage you to stay and ask any additional questions. I'm happy to answer them afterward. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next week, and this is Beverly Tomasian signing off.